You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Welcome to the Dressage Today podcast. This month, we are sponsored by Kentucky Performance Products, Elevate. Good morning, Aviva.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? I'm fighting some allergies. It's my radio announcer voice.
Ooh, it's very sexy. I like it. Well, we are still struggling with snow and ice here in Maryland. Had another little snowstorm last night, just enough to be annoying. So we've had about 5 weeks now of not very pleasant weather. Mm. How about you guys?
It's so frustrating. Well, we had a little warm up. We had some rain and we didn't have a freeze after the rain. So it warmed up. It was in the 80s this week. So the hairy horses were like, ah, it's hot. And stuff started growing and my allergies showed up and said, good morning, it's spring. And then last night we got down into the high 30s again. And tonight we're supposed to have a freeze warning. So, you know, it's Florida. Wait 5 minutes. If you don't like the weather, it'll change.
Well, we kind of say that about Maryland,
too. We're on the way out.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you know, this weather has made me think about some things. You know, for those of our listeners who have indoor arenas and live in snow areas, you know, we talk about the great melt. We talk about when the snow starts to slide off the roof. And I will say that one day I was walking down to the barn and I was halfway down my driveway and I heard what sounded like a horse kicking in the barn. And I thought either somebody's mad or, oh my God, I think somebody's cast. And I started to walk faster and all of a sudden I heard this whooshing sound. I mean, literally it sounded as if a train was coming at me and half of the snow off of one side of my barn slid off the roof, and then I heard this thud. And that's really scary. And, you know, we joke about it, and we talk about how hard it is to ride, but I made a decision. You know, my horse is a little bit sound sensitive, but, you know, he's an old man. He's been around for a long time, and he knows stuff, and he's not spooky. And so without really thinking about it, a couple days after the snow, before the melt even started, we couldn't get the horses out because there was too much ice. I had let the horses run in the indoor and I got my horse all tacked up and I went into the indoor and his head went straight up in the air and he went, oh my God, something's wrong. And okay. So I hand walked him around the arena and he couldn't even go near the walls. He couldn't go near the windows.
Wow.
It was really weird. I don't know what it was about, but I thought, you know, okay, he's a brave boy. He's, you know, sometimes he's better when I'm on his back. I walked him over to the mounting block. His entire body was shaking, Stephanie. So I made a decision not to ride. And there was this little part of me inside that thought, you're such a wimp. You're such a
no.
wimp. Everybody
no.
else rides. And then I thought about it, and I thought about what we owe ourselves and what we owe our horses and what the purpose of our riding is. And, you know, number one, riding is supposed to be fun. And when your horse is afraid that he's going to die any second, that's not fun.
Not fun.
Number two, we ride for harmony with our horses and for communication with our horses. And we ride to train our horses. And when our horses aren't in a mental or emotional place to listen, it's wasted. So I think a lot of people struggle with that. Am I being a weenie because I don't want to get on? Am I being a weenie because today I don't think I want to canter? And I think that one of the things that I just want to say to our listeners is trust your gut. And your horse doesn't know that you didn't canter today.
Yeah.
Your horse doesn't know that you didn't get on his back today. And your horse doesn't care. But your horse does know if you're sitting on him and your hands are tight and you're not breathing, and your butt muscles are so tight that he feels like he's got spikes in his back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a good thing.
No.
So, you know, just sort of, it's not only giving yourself grace, it's also thinking about the importance of what you're doing and how you're doing it. So that was my
Absolutely.
Little epiphany during this snow. So my horse was a nut for 3 weeks. He was a complete nut. And I got on him a couple times and it wasn't fun because riding tension to me isn't fun. And then one day I got on him and my horse was back.
Yeah.
And I had a ride and it was fine. So, you know, sometimes they know more than we do. And
well,
unless I'm going to the Olympics, what difference does it make?
Yeah. I completely understand and empathize with you. I have been teaching out in Montana. They mm-hmm. have a clear span, so it's, you know, it's a half circle
yes.
top.
Yeah.
And I spook. I think I spook more than the people that live there do, or the horses that live there do, but it is terrifying to hear that sound.
Yes.
But you know, I'm backing my 3/4-year-old now.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done all the groundwork. I can look at him and I see in his eye, he's very okay. I can see in his body posture while I'm doing the groundwork, he's very okay. I can sit on him and I can feel that in his back, he is very okay.
Mm-hmm.
And last week, I went through this whole diatribe in my head of it's time to get out of the round pen, or it's time to trot in the round pen, which is, you know, he's big and I don't love round pens for much more than walk. And I just couldn't do either one. And I said to my husband, Chris, mm-hmm. I want to get a hold of the head cowboy's son. Mm-hmm. I just need to see somebody ride my horse in the field
and know
who
he's okay.
doesn't care.
Yep.
And I really struggled with that. And he did not, he kept forgetting to do it. So I kind of said to myself, you know what? I can do this. And if I can't do it, I'll just get off. So I did long line him in the field. Actually, I went back to the rope work, stopped long lining, went back to the rope work, worked him in the field. He looked great. I got on in the field.
Wow.
And, you know, there was definitely a magnet towards the gate, which I had smartly shut.
Yeah.
I'm in a 5-acre field with a pond and 2 ditches.
Yeah.
You know, so, but I steered him and I stopped him. And I think he probably got a little frustrated. He's a horse that likes to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I just didn't have it in me to trot that day,
yeah.
but I got on him.
Good for
and
you.
It felt okay. But I also, in my head, I had that, if I need to, I can get off.
Yeah. You know, I after my last really bad fall,
mm-hmm.
when I stuck it out because, you know, you have to end with success, which is, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband said to me, and my trainer said to me, you are a good enough rider that if you are afraid, there is probably a reason and you should get off.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that was very profound and very life-changing for me. I just, after all this time, I just read the Charlotte Desjardins, the girl who dances, or the girl with the
oh,
dancing
yeah.
horse.
Was it good?
Okay. But one of the things that she talked about was one of her young horses was kind of scary, and she waited to have somebody else ride it to see that it was okay before she got on. If an Olympian can do that,
yep.
who are we trying to impress?
Yep, absolutely.
You know, I think there's so much ego in this sport. And, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine the other day about somebody we know who is a trainer and who rides the horses that nobody else wants to ride. And she goes to shows and, you know, she's thrilled because she stayed in the ring.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, I don't ride to stay in the ring. I ride to create harmony with my horse. I ride to make my horse better. I ride for communication. I don't want to ride just to be able to stay on or mm-hmm. stay in the ring. You know, mm-hmm. to me, that's not what this is about.
It isn't setting anybody up for success.
No, no, no. Somebody once said to me, we were talking about what do we do for a living? And she said to me, you teach people how to better communicate with their horses. That's your job.
Mm.
And it made me a little teary eyed. I mean, that was a lovely way of putting it that, you know, and that's sort of what dressage is, isn't it? It's about learning how to better communicate with our horses. It's about learning mm-hmm. how to dance with our horses. And if you're in a situation where you don't feel like you can dance or your horse doesn't feel like it can dance, maybe you either need to not try that day or find a different approach.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
That's the end of my rant.
No,
but as I said, I've been thinking about that.
Yeah.
I've been thinking about that a lot. So for those of you who are
chicken, discretion is the larger part of valor.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if you're afraid your horse knows it.
That saying has lasted.
Yeah. Absolutely. And if you're afraid your horse knows it. And if your horse knows you're afraid and you're supposed to be the leader and they can't trust you because you're scared. Then one of two things happens. Either they're scared too, or they take over as the leader. And that's not a good thing either.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not a good decision-making situation.
No, not at all. Yeah.
Well, despite our wacky weather down here, there have been lots of opportunities for me to go learn and watch. So where have I been? I have been to the FEI Trainer Symposium and got to watch Heike Kimmer and Christian Umbach, who is a 5-star judge, work with a large group of people with some really lovely horses. I got to go to the master class where Kira Kirkland, Catherine Dufour, and Jan Brink taught.
Elementary.
Of each other or of the riders?
Yeah, of each other. I mean, did their styles mesh? Did they match?
Well, so Catherine and Jan both ride with Kira.
Oh, okay.
They both
so,
work with Kira. So
okay.
yes,
so it is.
Did.
It is a consistent system.
Yes, and Catherine very very coolly. Catherine got on the second horse, and I didn't know. You know, I've not seen her ride in person before, so. The people that I was there with, we're watching the second horse come in, and it's on a long rein. We don't know who it is at this point, and we're both kind of, we were like,
It's
well,
a horse.
It was Catherine Dufour, and I was like, oh, well. But what I really appreciated about her is that she did not, in a masterclass setting on a horse that I think she'd sat on earlier that day for like 20 minutes.
Yeah.
She did not come in and give the impression of, I am the trainer and this horse will do as I ask. She got to know the horse in front of us.
Oh, that's lovely.
And she talked her way through it. So the three of them were, you know, commenting as she rode, but she truly, the horse that you saw her ride in on, and the horse
not the
that
one she rode out.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that to me, that is what our sport needs to be about. It's not that you can make them do. It's that you can get them to come with you.
Yeah.
So I really loved that. And then I got to go to Friday Night Lights this week with the big freestyle, and I got to see Isabel Wirth compete. So I can now say that I've seen Isabel Wirth compete in person.
I saw her at the Olympics with Klaus Balkenhol and Gigolo.
Anki.
Nicole.
No, Gigolo. Anki rode. Anki
no, you're thinking Bonfire.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would say the whole thing was very good for my eye. I came home with some renewed vigor as to, like, I could be getting more oomph out of the fabulous Dantelicious and more suppleness, which comes from more oomph. And then I also saw some stuff that I was like, yeah, I don't need to do that.
Yeah.
There were some, one of the very rewarding things watching the FEI trainer symposium was how frequently both of them were telling people to let go of their reins.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Let go of their reins. Let the horse's neck go. Let the horse stretch in between, you know, in between asks. What was a little bit disappointing was seeing how many people couldn't, because from a biomechanics standpoint, their hands were fairly involved in their seat.
Oh.
And that's where I'm going to leave that.
Well, I was very fortunate when I first started riding. The Potomac Valley Dressage Association arranged to have Reiner Klimke do a clinic. And I got to watch. And the thing that he kept saying was, make him an offer with the reins. Make him an offer.
Beautiful thing to say. Yes.
And it has always stuck with me.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I had the opportunity a couple years ago to ride with this biomechanics person named Stephanie Crossman. And she said something that was also very profound and life changing to me. And she talked about the fact that the arm from your shoulder to your elbow is a part of your seat.
Mm.
And if your seat is not solid, then you ride from strength and not from core. And you ride from pulling, not from balance. And that was something that was very profound for me. And it's something that I tell my students a lot. You know, this is part of your seat. This is not your hand. This is part of your seat. Your hand is here.
Ha ha ha.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
so I know what you're saying when you say they couldn't give because their seat wasn't there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There were a lot of people, and I mean, they were on some lovely horses and they've done a lovely job of training the movements.
Yeah.
But there was a good number of people that I was like, oh, I just need one lesson with you and I could make such a difference here. But, you know,
yeah,
it is what it is. Are you seeing any of the following signs of vitamin E deficiency in your horse? Stiff, sore muscles, neurological issues, lack of energy, poorly developed top line, or a weak immune system. Studies show that vitamin E levels drop when horses don't have enough access to fresh green grass. Elevate Natural Vitamin E can help. A research-proven, powerful antioxidant, Elevate maintains healthy muscle, nerve, and immune functions. It does this by delivering highly bioavailable source of natural vitamin E that is preferentially absorbed and retained in a horse's tissue. Elevate comes in four formulas: a fast-acting water-soluble liquid, a maintenance powder for long-term care, a concentrated veterinary formula powder, and a vitamin E and selenium powder. For more information, visit kppusa.com or call them at 859-873-2974. We have an Ask the L question from Chloe.
Okay.
And it is, do judges consider whether a rider has their test called versus having it memorized? Is that something that matters to the judges?
You know, it really doesn't.
Mm.
You are not allowed to have your test called in a championship show, and FEI is not allowed to be read either. But for national level shows, non-championship shows, the only time that it bothers me is if there are two rings close to one another and there are readers in both. And I keep hearing the other test and I'm like, shut up. That's not the test that I'm supposed to be watching. Mm-hmm. That is annoying. There are times that I am annoyed because a reader is just so loud and overpowering that it makes it a little bit difficult for me to concentrate on what I'm doing. But most of the time I realize that there's somebody out there talking and then I don't notice it anymore. So no, Chloe, if you can't remember your test, have somebody call it for you. Make sure it's somebody that you practice with because a lot of times the caller does it too soon or too late.
That's what I was thinking. Is a bad reader better than no reader?
Well, you know, there have been times that I have been judging, and you know, the reader is behind the writer, and I'm thinking to myself, oh, can you catch up, because they need to know what they're doing next and you're not there. But that's not my responsibility, so I just keep on judging.
You just keep judging very pointedly.
Yeah. And then the other thing is, you need to make sure that your reader doesn't teach you while they're reading. You can only read what is written in the test. Don't read what's in the parentheses.
Mm-hmm.
And don't do things like, at H, halt.
Yeah.
You know, everything needs to be just sort of read. You can't teach, you can't give assistance, and you can't repeat.
I am thinking about a time a long time ago when I was working for a woman who, she was at a show with her mother-in-law, and I was merely grooming, thank goodness. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what level it was. I don't know. It was, you know, second or above. It was a test. You know, it wasn't just like, this is okay. And the mother-in-law was reading the wrong test. And the writer knew, I think she just wanted somebody reading just in case. Yeah. So she knew her test. So she's doing her test.
And her mother-in-law is reading something else.
Well, and the mother-in-law's watching her not do what she tells her to do, so she's reading with more vehemence.
Oh my.
For the whole test. She never clued in.
Wow.
Never clued in. And I was
as a judge, that would really annoy me. Yeah.
Yes. But you know, everybody's just sitting there like waiting for something to happen and just trying to get through the test.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Something. So. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you for that. I know it wasn't our usual in-depth answer, but you know, sometimes it can be a really simple answer to a question like that. So
isn't that nice? You don't have to listen to
me
talk.
We do love that. Oh, I always like listening to you talk. So we're going to have a word from our sponsor, but first we want to introduce our interviewee for the day, Anne Muenstahl. She is our first hometown hero. And with more than 40 years of experience teaching both amateur and professional riders, Anne has come to appreciate the profound importance of establishing a strong, reliable foundation in every rider's training. She's been fortunate to train horses and riders through every level of dressage, from training to Grand Prix. This breadth of experience has given her a deep understanding of how to guide riders in the correct execution of dressage exercises at the advance, from the early education of the young horse to the refined work required of the elite dressage athlete. She's got a wide background of dressage education, from riding at Morven Park International Equestrian Center to working with various trainers at Temple Lipizzans to her favorite mentor, Juan Matuta, and has a deep love of bringing horses of all types along, whether they were typical or atypical horses for dressage. So we're looking forward to sharing her interview with us.
That should be a fun interview.
Yes. Today, we are joined by Anne Muenstahl. Anne, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And of course, we have Aviva. Yay.
Hi. And this is our inaugural, our inaugural presentation of our Hometown Heroes section.
Yeah.
And this is something kind of special. We've been asking our listeners to give us the name of somebody who has been particularly important in their riding and horse journey, not necessarily a dressage person, not necessarily somebody famous, but somebody who really made a difference and an impact. And Anne, you are the first hometown hero. Congratulations.
And we want to thank Nancy Gilby for sending this to us and making us aware of you.
even that takes a good amount of bravery to put yourself out there and say, hey, I love this person. So yep. We appreciate that. So, Anne, let's start at the beginning. How did you get into horses?
So as a kid, I begged my mother and begged her to get me a horse. And she had always wanted a horse as a child. So we went out and she got me a horse, a Palomino gelding for $150. Now, this was a long time ago, but still, we were told the horse was 12. It was 22.
Oh, my.
So, you know, it was that kind of a story. And we kept it boarded at a beautiful state park. And it had gorgeous trails. And I would take my horse to the field and ride it in circles, thinking I was training my horse. So I was definitely a dressage rider in the making. I was on my circles.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Where were you? What state were you in?
That was in Maumee, Ohio.
Okay.
And so then my 22-year-old Palomino gelding did die. And a woman at the stable asked me if I would ride her Arabian mare. She didn't ride, but she owned two Arabians and she wanted me to ride her Arabian mare. So she took me from Toledo to Dayton, which is about 2 hours, every Saturday and Sunday for 2 years. And I trained with Jim Colvick, who was a Western Pleasure Arabian trainer. And
wow.
I showed in Western Pleasure for those years.
Wow.
And so then it came time for college, and I wanted to go to a college that had a equestrian program. Mm-hmm. And my parents said, oh, no, there's no future in horses, in a career for horses. You can't do that. So I went to the University of Michigan and got a degree in American history.
But because there are jobs in American history.
So then I saved up my money to send myself to an equestrian program, and I went to Morven Park International Equestrian Institute in Leesburg.
Oh, right down the street from me. Okay.
Yes. And it was a really intense program, 7 days a week for a year. You did 3 hours of riding every day. One of those hours was on a lunge line, getting your position and seat. And we had veterinary classes, we had management classes, we cleaned stalls, we groomed the horses, we cleaned the tack. 40 students started the program and only 14 graduated.
Wow.
Yeah, it's so grueling. Yeah. But it gave me, this is also where I was introduced to dressage.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know about dressage before this. And so that's sort of that's my start.
Who was the dressage trainer when you were there?
The Colonel Darley was the British colonel that ran it at the time. There was always one that was brought in. And then we had I was taught by Lee Craft, and another trainer was actually my barn trainer, and they were trained in dressage. But this was just the start. Because obviously you don't learn dressage in a year, but
you don't.
Oh no! I
ah, darn. So what made you pick dressage as your thing?
Yes. So I was a classical ballet dancer, trained in classical ballet for 15 years.
Wow.
So dressage was a real natural fit for me. The discipline it takes and the daily exercises were very familiar. Basically, I thought I was training my horse to be a dancer, which I loved. I was completely taken by this and trying to become harmonious and light and graceful was just like dancing. So it was just perfect for me.
Wow.
That's a terrific assimilation, because if you're trying to tell somebody about dressage that doesn't know anything about horses, I think a lot of people say, well, it's ballet for horses. So it does make a good association. So I think that is a really good simile that you used, because when I describe dressage to people who don't know anything about horses, I will always say, it's kind of like ballet for horses. So
yes.
I see those two going together well.
Yes.
And now, considering we're just going through the Olympics, the other thing that I say to describe it is it's like ice dancing.
It definitely.
You know, it's a pair. It's a couple dancing together.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, we're not on ice.
No. Well, we have been here in Maryland for a while, but no, not with the horses.
Tippy toes.
Yeah. So after you left Morven Park, what did you do?
So
what came next for you?
I came back to Ann Arbor, which is where I was living after I graduated from U of M, and I started teaching at local stables.
Mm-hmm.
I kept training with everybody that I could. I did a lot of clinics. I trained with different trainers in my area, and I also went and taught at Culver Military Academy, which was an interesting experience.
Oh, neat.
I was the first instructor to begin teaching the girls because they had just admitted girls to the school.
And
so that was kind of cool. And I have a sort of funny story about it. So Culver is also known for its polo. And I asked the male instructors if they would just show me how to ride a polo horse. And they went and got a horse that I didn't know this about, but would lay down on the rider. Right?
Of course they did.
It just supposed to really be embarrass me. So anyway, I'm on the horse and the horse stopped and thought he might do something downwards. And I had ridden a lot of difficult horses at Morven Park. So I just said, "What are you doing?" And I just bumped him with my legs and the horse got up or didn't even actually go down. And then he started to work perfectly like a polo horse. So this is how I got my acceptance at Culver as a good enough rider that they would accept me as the only woman instructor there.
And, you know, teaching polo riders dressage is a real experience. I have a student who is a polo player and brilliant. She's a brilliant, capable, wonderful, fabulous rider. But it's all basically, you know, seat of your pants balance.
Oh, I know.
And, you know, developing the idea of a seat and the different aids and the subtleties has been really difficult for her.
Yes, yes. It's so very different. I never got any good at it, but I was able to keep the horse from laying down.
From laying down. Yeah, that's a great thing.
That sounds like it was better than everybody else.
Yes. And then I came back to Ann Arbor, and my husband and I bought a piece of property. And after a year and a half of saving all our money, we built a small stable with an indoor arena. And that is where I started Rose Hill, which is the name of my dressage training stable.
Okay. And why did you name it Rose Hill? Was there any family background on that?
No, I loved roses and the farm had roses on it. So I just called it, and it's hilly. And so I just named it Rose
Perfect.
Hill.
Perfect.
Lovely. Lovely. Now, you mentioned training with a lot of different people, and you did some time with some of the Libazon people.
Yes. So I went to Temple Farms over 6 years and trained with Hans Riegler, Andreas Hausberger, and Arthur Kottes. And I would take 3 to 4 horses every time I went, and we would school 3 days every time we went there. And of course, obviously, super classical training.
Yeah.
And it was invaluable. I mean, it was some of the best teaching that I had. So, and I watched in the afternoons, we would watch all the Lipizzans do the airs above the ground and all the Piaf. And they were wonderful at all the Piaf and Passage. And it's one of my places where I learned the most.
Wow. Would you say that they are the most influential trainers that you've worked with, or is there somebody else?
No, there are others. I went to Europe to find a horse for one of my clients. I saw 40 horses from Belgium, Netherlands, France, Germany, And then I went to Spain. And in Spain, I met Juan Matute, three-time Olympian and for Spain. And I met the Spanish horse. And Juan, I trained with Juan in Spain. I trained with him in Florida. I trained with him in Kentucky and in Michigan. And over 20 years, I would say now. Wow. And over these years, I also, he chose, over these years, we did imported 20 horses that he has chosen for me. Mm-hmm. And I would say that those horses are also my heroes because of what they taught me. And so he was super influential in my career.
So do you specialize in the Spanish horses? Would you call that?
So I have 7 Spanish horses and 7 mm-hmm. warm bloods.
Okay.
So
it's nice mix.
Yes. But I love the Spanish horse because of they are so intelligent. They're so flexible. They so want to please you. But yes. Some of this actually makes them not so easy to ride because they are able to move everywhere. So you really mm-hmm. have to balance them and keep them in a straight, keep them straight and collected so that they aren't swimming around. And they're super sensitive. So, mm-hmm. and they're always like one step ahead of you. They think they know what you want and they're trying to offer it to you. And that can be disconcerting to a lot of riders. But for me, it's such a pleasure.
Hmm. I think it can be like learning to drive a Lamborghini on an icy road.
Yes.
You've got to have such finite, finite control.
Yes.
Do you have a preference for the PREs versus the Lusitanos, or do you like all Spanish horses equally?
I like all Spanish horses. Each one is such an individual. I also now have 2 Spanish sport horses, and what they were doing in Spain is developing the mix of PRE with different breeds. So some of them are mixed with warm blood, some are mixed with thoroughbred. Oh, actually, I had 3 because I did have 1 mixed with a thoroughbred early on in my career. And so these are really, really lovely horses as well. They're breeding them to be a little bit bigger, a little bit more long-legged. And I think they are developing them for sort of like a high level performance, like Olympics and things, because they'll compete more with the warm bloods. Although some of the PREs are amazing in their own right.
Yeah.
I'm sure you knew this, that we recently lost a lovely Spanish horse that was aimed at being a team horse, Leader 7.
Yeah.
And if you, anybody ever saw that horse working, he was such a lovely example of what that breed can do at a high level.
Yes.
So it was a big loss. And he was a buckskin, which I just think that's the best part of the whole thing.
It is. I have a buckskin Lusitano.
Oh, how fun.
He's very cute. Very, very cute.
So the 14 horses that you have, those are all yours, or there are some yours, some are training horses?
So they're students' horses. Mm-hmm. I own a number of the horses in a partnership with students. And then I have 2 school horses to teach riders that don't have horses. And mm-hmm. but all the rest of them are in, there are 9 horses in full training.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Which is a big day.
Yeah.
And at what point did you start teaching? Would you say like the majority of your day is teaching or training at this point?
It's basically half and half. I ride 5 to 6 horses a day and teach 5 to 6 lessons. It's basically half and half.
Okay.
Okay.
And do you have a preference? If you could only do one for the rest of your time, would you prefer to train or would you prefer to teach?
Train.
Okay. Do you have a favorite horse?
I love being on the horses. I love riding. So, you know, I was thinking about that, and each one of them is so different that you love things about each one of them. Like one of the horses that I actually own in partnership with Nancy, is one of the CDE horses, which is the Spanish sport horse. And he is the sweetest, most honest horse I've ever met. Mm-hmm. But he's super sensitive, and he is part Spanish horse, part Arabian. And he's 16-1.
Oh, he's big.
Oh, he's big and a swan neck when he goes, and long, graceful legs, and just a delight to be around. Everybody loves him. And then I have a student's PRE that I'm going to be showing. It's a black PRE. We're working up to the Grand Prix level. And he is one who is so stable in the bridle and in the frame that is just a pleasure. And he needs to just work more elastically through his back. So each horse has things that are wonderful and things that I work on. So there really isn't a favorite of all the ones that I ride.
Mm. What would you say sets your program apart? What would you say is the thing that makes people say, we want to ride with Anne?
So I would say that it is my commitment and understanding of classical dressage training. It really and truly, I sort of have an acronym that we use in the barn, which is BSIC. And it's balance, straightness, impulsion, connection. And everything is nice. Based on this. Mm-hmm. And whenever you run into a problem, you go back down and check BSIC. Do you have all the pieces in place? And then you do it again. And I think that this gives riders that come to me and horses that come to me, it takes time to do this, but it will last you forever. It will last mm-hmm. you as you go up the levels. It's really the only way to be successful, or you're going to find out, maybe you thought you had it, but you'll find out at third level, it doesn't work anymore. Don't really, mm-hmm. the horse can't do this anymore. And really, you just have to stick to the classical dressage principles. I think another thing is my attitude towards the horse, which is we nurture dressage horses. Actually, you nurture all horses, but mm-hmm. it's a nurturing program. It's not forceful. Patience. I have one student who says, I cannot believe how patient you are because we would have to change this in the tack, or maybe this in the shoeing, or this. And I have extraordinary patience, which is important to develop these horses up the levels. You have to mm-hmm. be ready to commit to them for a long time.
Yes.
I also think it's the attitude towards the rider. So I try to keep all of my instruction positive. It doesn't mean I don't correct you all the time, because I do, but dressage is complicated and difficult mm-hmm. at best for riders as they're learning. And there's going to be many, many, many errors, many, many mistakes. And I feel that it is partly my job to keep their confidence up, letting them know that those mistakes are normal.
Yes.
When I see they're about ready to tear their hair out, I have to stop and tell them it's okay. Yeah. You and your horse will get this, but it takes a lot of repetition and you have to follow the steps to get better. And it just is a slow process. I also think one of the really, really important things, and I think Nancy would agree, she's here, is the attention to detail, which is not only in the riding, but in the day, the life of the horse during the day. You have to watch for very early signs of any kind of unsoundness, mm-hmm. Saddle fit, mm-hmm. bridle bit fit, their nutrition. Mm-hmm. We do unmounted exercises, stretching exercises, physiotherapy exercises that we've been taught by good physiotherapists. We condition them. We make sure that they are, the young horse is started in the conditioning program so they actually get the strength to do the work they're going to be asked to do. Shoeing is crucial. I work with the blacksmiths every single time they're there with each horse. And they marvel at how the tiniest change to keep the horse's feet, front feet level, how could that make such a difference? It makes
a huge
difference. Footing, making sure my husband, bless his soul, rakes my footing every single day.
Wow.
So the footing is always perfect. And that also makes for success with the horse.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I have a funny story. I was on the board of Horses Haven, which is a horse rescue, a big mm-hmm. horse rescue. And I was also the trainer for them. So our plan was to bring horses in and train them so that they could be adopted as a riding horse. So when they got really difficult horses over there and the horse wouldn't settle down, they would say, we have to bring this horse to you and you've got to help us with this. And they would get off the trailer and come in the barn and into the arena. And all of a sudden this horse, I hadn't even done anything. The horse was like relaxed and ready to work. Like it was the atmosphere in the stable. And I think they actually picked it up from the other horses. Mm-hmm. Not the people.
Sure.
They could probably, all the horses in the barn were happy or something, or at least they were relaxed. And so it was just really, it happened so many times we had to take notice.
Yeah.
That's lovely. To be able to provide that for the horses, because they don't choose to be dressage horses. They probably would all be happy just out eating grass together.
Mm-hmm.
But to know that they feel that confident and relaxed in an atmosphere where training is going on, is that's just wonderful to hear.
Yes. And then there was one other thing I wanted to tell you. The other thing that I love is developing horses that you wouldn't necessarily think would make a great dressage horse.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Either because they didn't have some amazing talent or they had issues, something wrong with them. We had an 11-year-old PRE come to me and he had a serious quarter crack on one hoof, but it was actually the other hoof. It was bouncing off the opposite hoof that made this quarter crack. So there was a very subtle unsoundness going on that would pass the vets, but you could feel just a little landing heavy on the one with the crack and not so heavy on the right front. So we investigated this. I had a very good lameness specialist help me. It took us a while to fix the quarter crack and then find out the problem in the opposite foot. And it took 2 years to bring this horse back to total soundness. But again, remember, we did a rehab program, but you couldn't visually see the unsoundness, but you could feel it.
Yeah.
And now the tension became very tense and the tension has all gone away as we have made this comfort level for him.
Yeah.
So I think those kinds of stories, I was lucky enough to work with a lameness specialist for 15 years in my area, and he would take me on calls and he would make me watch hours of horses move and then have to tell him where the problems were.
Wow.
So for 15 years, I had to study this movement and be able to get a better eye as to where is the problem and what can I do about it. So I was
what a wonderful education.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Have you?
So you're clearly.
No. No.
She really jumped on that. No. Did you notice?
The adamant. Yes.
It's just, you have to be, that's a whole nother skill level.
Thank you.
It is. I mean, you have to be, you just have to know everything. And it's just not something I'm trained to do. At some point, if I don't ride anymore, then maybe I would. But I think that judging is complicated and hard to do. And you have to be really focused and all day long. Sometimes I don't know how they do it so well as they do.
Passion, just like you have the passion for teaching.
Yes.
Yeah. So you have this wonderful passion for teaching and this commitment to taking as long as it takes. which I think is wonderful because some horses, as you said, move more quickly than others. What would you say your pet peeve is with teaching?
Okay. I think that riders who are disappointed in their horses.
Thank you.
And the horse for mistakes. They don't understand how, I mean, when you think about what we're doing, we're asking an animal to perform for us and we expect them to understand what we want them to do when half the time the rider didn't understand it either.
Yep.
So it says the horse isn't listening, but maybe you aren't speaking to the horse in a way that they can understand what you want. So that's my pet peeve. And I
bless you.
It's kind of natural for riders to get that way because they get frustrated. So it is my constant job to point out that if you did it like this, then the horse would understand what you are asking for. And then you will get what you want. But if you are making this mistake, you have confused your horse or you didn't really tell the horse to do that. It's just, it's communication. And that is, I think, the understanding of how difficult the horse's job is. The other thing is not overworking a horse when they're not strong. Not saying, okay, well, we're going to do it another time. Well, the horse has just done it 3 times. You can't do 20 times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So being really on the horse's side, I think, is important.
Any kids coming up in your program? I know that you do a lot of ladies of a certain age.
Yes.
But do you ever have kids that come through your program?
I used to have a lot more because I had an instructor that would teach the kids. There were just too many lessons for me to do both. Okay. So but I don't have an instructor at the moment that teaches kids. So not currently.
Okay.
Do you have any hobbies besides the horses? Or it's because you have your own farm, your husband is raking your arena every day, you're riding 5 or 6 horses, you're teaching 5 or 6 lessons. When do you have time to do anything else and what do you do?
So I train agility dogs.
Of course you do.
Dressage for dogs.
Yep. What kind of dogs?
So I have 2 Nova Scotia duck tolling retrievers.
Oh, neat.
And yes, they are the high drive dogs, which you need in agility, and they're nicknamed tollers. And I have 2 of them. One is the aunt of the other one. And I train them 4 days a week.
Wow.
And then they have to do exercises. They do dressage exercises. Goodness, I taught one of my trainers what shoulder in is for a dog. Because you need to have engagement. And so.
Oh, that's so fun.
Very similar. In reality, they led.
So really all you do is dressage. Oh, that's funny.
Gosh, that's amazing. And if you were mentoring somebody coming up in the business or somebody coming into the business, what wise words would you have for them?
Be patient. Stick to the fundamentals, the balance, the straightness, the impulsion, the connection. Mm-hmm. And in the beginning, in my opinion, in the beginning, those are just words. You don't really know what it feels like to be balanced or straight or how much impulsion. Mm-hmm. You don't know this in the beginning. I didn't know it in the beginning. It takes many, many horses. So ride as many horses as you possibly can. Don't be tempted to just make them fancy. Mm-hmm. I see that a lot now, is that they're really, you miss the basics, but you have a lot of action, but you don't really have balance. Mm-hmm. So this, again, is going to break down on the way up, or the horse is going to break down because they don't develop the strength in their backs that they need. I would say have the right attitude towards the horse and the students. There's always tomorrow. You don't have to fix everything today. You can you run into a problem, you can do it tomorrow if your horse is tired. Yep. Get the best instruction that you can get and do it often. Be looked at often. I train now with Eddie DeWolf Van Westerode, a 5-star Olympic judge. And I also work with a student of his that's in my area who's also a lameness specialist. And I try to be seen almost once a week with two horses, because you need eyes on the ground. You need to be watched all the time, especially if you want the horses to go up to the top levels. I would also say, watch all those things, the shoeing, the saddle fit, the bridle fit, watch all of the details, everything that's going to affect your horse, including the rider that's riding it. So if you have a problem, if a rider is crooked, you have to really work that out so that the horse can stay balanced. And then I would also say, enjoy the small successes, because they will lead you to the big achievements. But if you are only waiting for the big achievement, you will not be happy on a daily basis.
Well, I can certainly see why Nancy thinks of you as a hero.
Yes.
It's lovely. It's lovely that you spent time talking to us and telling us about yourself. You are very special.
Thank you.
Thank you
for sharing with us. We appreciate it. And we thank Nancy for putting you out there for us.
Yeah.
See.
Awesome.